Yeah, you never know. I mean, it's so good. It's quite a ways away to get there, but it's been so spectacular. You never know. I may do run up there again.
So, welcome to Beatrice, who hasn't been able to join us in a while. Beatrice, can you hear everything? Are you there, Beatrice?
Hear
He's not muted.
No, and Fanny's here and Corinna's here. Welcome, Corinna.
Hey there.
Corinna's at work, I think.
Yes.
So she's one of the invisible people today.
Congratulations, Fanny. She went. Oh.
Trying to unmute her, but I can't do it.
Oh, well.
Oh, wait, hold on. Okay. I can try to unmute her. No, it's not working.
Yeah. She must be muted from her end and must be like indelible work or something. All right. Well, Fanny, I hope you can hear us. And Beatrice, I hope you can hear us. And we know Corinna can hear us. And welcome to everybody else. And I'm turning it over to Loma Jinzong.
Hi, all. So I will start with the prayers, although I can't remember. What do we do in this class? Do we do the four in English or just the first one three times? How do you do it? I'm sorry.
We do the four. We do all of them in English.
And do you do it with
the lower? Is our tradition.
Do you do the first one three times and then the regular? Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And do you do it with the little melody or not?
Either way, that's your call. I'm going to mute everybody.
Okie dokie.
Whoops. Oh, sorry. Oh, I just unmuted everybody. I guess you had muted everybody.
I haven't touched it.
Okay, well, everyone is muted, including Lama Jinzong, so we will unmute her, and then we should be in business. Whoops. Okay.
Hold on.
Myself.
Okay, hold on. I just lost the picture, though. Oh, there you all are. Okay, here we go. Oh, in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru, four continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings. Please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And now the four prayers to be recited by teachers before teachings. First is the four Dharmas of Gompopa. Dak dak sem chen tam che lu ju su jo war sin ji lap tu so chu lam du jo war sin ji lap tu so lam chu par se war sin ji lap tu so chu pa ye she su jo war sin ji lap tu so I pray for a blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai yi ke dan lu dan nu ji che nu jin ke ju pu da tam mi yi ke dan da jo wa kun ji dra ke ci chan pa tam che ke du da ke ju ten tu. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And if you have this page, the top where it says reminder for arousing bodhicitta at the beginning of teachings, you can join me. If not, just listen. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And so to begin with, I think it would be nice to just settle for a few moments and just, you know, again, sort of pay attention to our bodies right now and just relax and do a quick body scan to have a sense of where we might have any tension in the body or, you know, stress, and bring our awareness to it and consciously let go, or make an effort to simply let go and relax. Just again to bring our minds back to, you know, feel embodied again. Okay, so now I'm going to begin with In Love with the World, and I know everyone, right, correct, has the book, I believe. If not, you know, I'll be reading from it. So if you do have the book, I'll push my hand back a little. So, okay. So where we're going to begin today is a little... Lama Chodron had finished sheet around 37. I'm going to just go back just a little bit and beginning on page 31. And how I'll run the class today is I'm basically going to run through or read out the sections that so affected me. And we'll do the longer meditation that's in the book as it comes up. We won't be repeating the meditation Lama Chodron did last week. And then, of course, if anyone has any questions, whatever, please raise your hand, either your computer hand or your hand. And hopefully, Chodron, if you don't mind, Lama Chodron, you can help me with the unmuting. So we'll begin on page 31. And it's after the break, and it says the five senses, because I feel like this was really helpful to understanding, you know, how the mind works, breaking it down. And of course, in the Buddhist description, you have six or eight consciousnesses, and five of the consciousnesses refer to each of the five senses: sight, smell, sound, taste, and tactile, and then the consciousness of the mental consciousness. And so this begins when it says the five senses. This is referring to the five the five sensory consciousnesses, or the senses, I should say. So it begins, it says, the five senses always report neutral information. To the ear, sound is always just sound, nothing more. Like and dislike are shaped by the interpretive mind that remembers, adds, modifies, and spins. The interpretive mind creates entire fictions around just sound, just sight. The voice that provides this running commentary is the monkey mind. It chatters away, jumping from one sense object to the next, overly active and quite excitable. So I'm going to continue here. It says, I have a student who once rented a cabin for a week on the coast of Oregon. Every morning he woke up and lay in bed listening to the sounds of waves coming ashore and rolling back to sea. Swish, swish, again and again. He told me he had never heard a more soothing sound, and that the sound itself made him feel embraced by a universal love. On his last day, he packed his car and headed to the highway, planning to spend a night on the road. Sometime after dark, he followed signs to a motel. He checked in, exhausted, and fell asleep. In the morning, he could not believe his good luck to wake up one more time to the soothing, rhythmic swish of waves. When he got out of bed and went to the window, he saw a highway with six lanes of rush hour traffic. Misidentifications of sense perceptions happen all the time and make the body the best laboratory for learning about our minds. What had just happened on the train? So now I'm reading this again to, again, just keep us rooted in where Mincha Rinpoche is. My ear had detected a sound. Not a good sound or a bad sound, just contact between the sense organ and the object. Then what? My mind had gotten swept up in a negative story to such an extent that I had forgotten that the words, images, and impressions that created the story were not true to any reality other than what was in my head. My student's mind had gotten swept up in a positive story, but in both cases, getting hooked up by a story means that we have lost touch with awareness. Both associations obscured simplicity of just sound. This is why we say the body is the home of the grasping mind. Misunderstandings about the source of sensation occur because the perception and the interpretation arise almost simultaneously, so close together that the strong but incorrect impression is created that the interpretive reality, good, bad, attractive, aversive, is lodged within the object itself and not in the mind. It can be very difficult to accept that the source of what we like or do not like arises in our mind. When we get our heads stuck in the clouds, pretty clouds, ugly clouds, we cannot see that they are impermanent, that they have a life of their own, and that they will pass on if we let them. When we relate to the world with a mind full of preconceptions, we erect a barrier between us and reality as it is. And why I felt this explanation was so profound is that because, again, this notion that everything arises is awareness, you know, and how difficult it is to disconnect from this notion that what we experience is external to us. Because the fact is that every, as it says, the senses themselves and the consciousnesses of self are completely non-conceptual, and everything we have in our minds, even if we don't have a name for it, it's that that's a color. That's a color differentiated from the color next to it. That's a shape differentiated from the shape next to it. All of that is happening in the mind, in awareness. So I'm continuing now in the book 32. It says, holding misconceptions in place with a rigid mind is the same as grasping. We grasp onto what we know or to what fits with our limited experience, and this distorts direct, immediate perception. When we feel threatened by change, we try to hold things in place, which is another way of describing the aspect of self that refuses to let old patterns die. But if we cannot consciously allow patterns to die, then we cannot take advantage of the energizing benefits of regeneration. Impermanence, like emptiness, is an inherent characteristic of phenomena. Recognizing impermanence corrects misperceptions of permanence, but recognizing emptiness directly is even more helpful for working with attachment. Recognizing the fluidity of all forms disempowers the false claims of the fixed mind. In turn, this expands our sense of who we are and what we can do. It can be very liberating to know that our stories about train whistles or anxieties about our relationships or reputations are not inherently rooted within us, and to know that we have an innate capacity for transformation. But understanding impermanence as the outer layer of death can be even more effective for cutting through our irrational mental habits. For transformation to occur at the deepest levels, we do not just acknowledge the continuity of change, we recognize the process of dying and regeneration underlies the truth of impermanence. This is the greatest encouragement for our liberation. So that was also very profound for me, because we're always talking again about everything is dying. Everything, we're dying in every moment. We're dying in every moment. But this is focusing on the fact that, yes, impermanence means change, but it doesn't mean something dying, but that it also points to the fact that regeneration underlies that with every, in the process of death, is regeneration. So this is the greatest encouragement for our liberation. Yet our dread of physical death makes us resist the very idea of dying every day. We confuse the renewable deaths of our mental states with the ultimate death of our bodies. When we do this, every form of death and dying looms on the horizon as an inevitable nightmare, something that we spend our lives wishing will not happen. Actually, with some investigation, we can learn that what we dread as a future event is happening all the time. So now I'd like to skip to page 34 and start with the second line in the full paragraph here, where it says, because it skips over a story of a student of his, it says, the death of the small self, which I think of is the death of every moment, cannot be accomplished in a lasting or effective way if we deny or circumvent the fear of physical death. Yet working with the small deaths can loosen the intense anxieties that surround physical death. There is a natural path between impermanence and death, and if we remain unwilling to follow it through, then we short-circuit the remarkable benefits of continuous dying. To approach the finality of our bodies while paying no attention to the many deaths of daily life is like confusing diamonds with pebbles and throwing them away. Nothing endures but change, and accepting this has the potential to transform the dread of dying into joyful living. So I'd like to just take a moment now again to relax our minds. And we can take a moment and, considering what we've just read, I would say in this moment to just let go and relax. And what I mean to let go is let go of clinging as best we can, and that whatever arises, we notice it, but we just let go of clinging, that again, anything that arises at any moment is nothing but the radiance of our true nature of mind, of awareness itself, which is, while ungraspable, always exhibiting some form of phenomena. That mind itself is not nothingness. It is not a void. Emptiness in this sense can be defined as it's been said, as a manifest expression, so that we're constantly experiencing, but at the same time, everything that we're experiencing cannot be grasped at as any kind of substantial thing. So we can just relax. That again, whatever arises is like when you look at the ocean, you don't think of the waves as separate from the ocean, and yet the ocean, you don't think of as the waves and the ocean as separate from the ocean, or that the ocean is separate of the waves. It's all one thing. And so all of our experience can be considered as the waves of the ocean. So all experience is simply the, again, the expression or the movement of mind itself, of awareness itself. And now just let go of all thoughts. Or let's say whatever arises, I shouldn't say let go of thoughts, but simply let go of content itself and rest without clinging. And now we can return back to the book, page 35. And it says, once we move from the belief that things are unchanging to the experience that everything is transitory, the tension between our expectations and reality as it is begins to dissolve. Then we can know that the disturbance of this moment will pass, and that if we stay with the recognition of awareness, the problem will transform on its own. It doesn't need any help from us in order to move on. The inherent nature of everything is change. It's our preoccupation with the problem that nails it in place. Yet leaving it be is easier said than done. We are not familiar with abiding in the non-conceptual aspects of our mind and staying with our direct experience. We are so used to identifying with our ideas of who we are and merging our identity with people and places and with objects such as our cars and houses that the experience of the natural mind liberated from all this familiar matter can be frightening. It can be misinterpreted as nothingness, as a kind of annihilation. And if we do not recognize this as our basic home, then we can scramble to get away as quickly as possible and seek somewhere to land, which means we seek some familiar identity to reemerge with. What can be most helpful here is to lightly rest the mind on the qualities of awareness. Emptiness and spacious awareness have qualities of cognizance, or you could say knowingness. This is not nothingness. In the same way that the breath can support awareness practice, qualities of spacious awareness can themselves support resting the mind in non-conceptual states. So now what I'm going to do is skip over what Lama Chodron presented last week, which is that Mincha Rinpoche now is so disturbed by his surroundings and so distracted that he decides to choose sound as an object for calm abiding meditation and works with that sound itself. So since we did that last week, I'm going now to skip to page 38. And we're going to start now at the beginning of the third paragraph where it says, despite. So it says, despite the relief that I had enjoyed from sound meditation, intermittently sounds were again conditioned by fear, and I continued to hover between abiding calm and uncontrolled monkey in my mind and contemplations of sound. Right here, I thought, right now is where the suffering arises. Between the sound and the projection, between things as they are and things as we want them to be. This is what the Buddha taught, to perceive reality, to suffer. And this is very interesting, that sentence, the distinction between things as they are and things as we want them to be, because I know this is true in my experience. It's not that I, you know, when I look at experience, it's not just that resting, you're just aware of things, but in our hearts, because we are born in the desire realm, and one of the qualities of that is that we are simply addicted to feeling pleasure, addicted to being comfortable, to wanting to be happy, that it's not that we are able to see things as they are, because actually we are always seeing things as we want them to be. And that's why we suffer, because we're not happy or content with the conditions around us at any moment. We're always seeking somehow to change them to be what we feel we need in any moment, to feel safe, to feel comfortable, to have relief. So he says, to misperceive reality is to suffer. And I'm continuing on. It says, but why, I wondered, is it so hard to get it right? On this train, I have experienced fear more acutely than I have known it for many years. And I have felt my body constrict around the resistance to being where I am. I know that the fear of letting go of familiar identities of one's ego is fear of freedom itself. And I am trying. My father used to tell me, if you do not recognize the truth of impermanence, you cannot attain genuine realization. You must allow the illusion of ego to die. Only then can true wisdom arise. Only with the death of this ego can we know freedom. And I'm skipping now to the next paragraph where it says the term ego, because I thought what comes next is a fantastic explanation of what is meant by the term ego. And equally important then, at the last paragraph begins, what's considered a healthy sense of ego, which I've always had a question about. So it begins, the term ego or ego self is frequently used to describe the self-centered, fabricated outer layer of self. And we often speak of letting go of the ego or dissolving it or transcending it. I myself had thought of adding wood to the fire as an ego suicide mission. However, the common usage of ego, both within Buddhist teachings and in the world at large, makes ego sound like an entity that has a shape and a size and that can be extracted like a tooth. It doesn't work that way. Ego is not an object. It's more like a process that follows through on the proclivity for grasping and for holding on to fixed ideas and identities. What we call ego is really an ever-changing perception. And although it is central to our narrative story, it is not a thing. It therefore cannot really die and cannot be killed or transcended. This tendency for grasping arises when we misperceive the constant flow of our body and mind and mistake it for a solid, unchanging self. We do not need to get rid of this ego. Of the ego, this unchanging, solid, and unhealthy sense of self, because it never existed in the first place. The key point is that there is no ego to kill. It is the belief in an enduring, non-changing self that dies. The term ego can still provide a useful reference, but we need to be careful not to set ourselves up for battling something that is not there. Ironically, when we go into combat with the ego, we strengthen the illusions of self, making our efforts to awaken counterproductive. And now he goes into what is considered healthy ego. He says, because ego is frequently identified in negative term, especially amongst Buddhists, my father made a point of reminding me that we also have a healthy ego or a healthy sense of self. This relates to aspects of self that intuitively know right from wrong, that can discern between protection and harm, that instinctively know what is virtuous and wholesome. We trip ourselves up when we become attached to these basic instincts and create inflated stories about them. For example, I'd used ego in a positive way to explore and then maintain a monastic discipline. But if I were to think, oh, I am such a pure monk, I maintain my vows so perfectly, then I would be in trouble. When I examined my difficulties with too much newness all at once, I could see ego self as a process, not a solid thing. I was not able to allow all my previous identities to die at once. I needed time. I needed to work through the layers. I accepted that the roles I wished to toss into the pyre were fabricated, not inherent to my being, but they could not be extracted as if with a surgical procedure. I had grown into them, and I needed to grow out of them. And I think this is also an essential point, that we have this notion that somehow we can cut it off and that somehow we're bad if we can't figure out how to let go. And we've been trying and we've been trying and we still can't do it. And this is bad. And recognizing that our habits are so deeply ingrained, you know, forget about whether you believe about previous lifetimes. All of us are of an age now where, you know, clearly, and we're in a society that completely exalts the self and the ego. And so that we have to be kind, and this is a form of kindness and compassion, to recognize that we have to work through, as he says, the layers, that they can't just be extracted in one fell swoop, that we've grown into them and we need to grow out of them. You know, so I'm just now, we're entering into the next meditation, and so I thought it would be best just to continue reading to keep it in context of why he approached the meditation as he did. So it continues, as the train rumbled through the night, I continued to feel oddly cut off from my fellow travelers, from myself, and from yesterday's life. I kind of understood what was happening, but had never had such a visceral experience of it. I had wished to peel off the outer layers, but they do not peel back like adhesive tape. Neither do they remain passive in the process, but rather they fight to stay intact, as if saying, if you do not respect the Buddha's robes, I will wear them more proudly. If you cannot acknowledge that I am a man of heart, then I will isolate myself, even at the risk of more misery. And here comes his definition of the monkey mind, or the main job of monkey mind. Oh, the treacherous monkey, what a happy time it was having. Its main job is to convince us that deep in the jungle and the jumble of this glued together fabrication lies the real me, the essential true self that cannot change, that must keep faith with its fiction and with its neurotic habits. I frequently returned with mantra-like repetition to critical reminders. Mantra means to protect the mind, and this is just what I was trying to do, protect it from straying too far into mixed, fixed associations to fear. But this effort was foiled by my inability to truly transcend my own reaction to my circumstances, meaning that I was praying for them, those wretched others on the train. Again, I descended into an ice-cold realm of constriction. I did not want these unblessed strangers with their torn clothes and matted, lice-crawling hair to fall against me every time the train lurched. Yes, I aspire to be a happy yogi in all situations, but these crying babies and the stench of the overflowing toilets, who am I now? Who allowed these prickly eye, ear, smell, touch sensations to spin a web that is leaving me diminished, irritable, and alone? At one stop, I had been able to move from the floor to a wooden bench, and I now sat with my back pressed into the wooden slats of the seat. I knew that if I really wanted to become more flexible, I would have to drop down to a place beneath the separation of heart and mind. And so here we begin again. We're beginning with the meditation. And so I will, again, adjust your posture as best you can to have a straight back, however you're seated. seated, and now I will begin to read the instructions. Now again, I'll introduce some of his thoughts, but slowly I'll introduce some ways to think of it ourselves. So here we go. So when it says, I direct my mind, so think of it as you're directing your mind. So again, you've adjusted your posture. Sorry for my squeaky chair. And it says, first, I direct my mind to rest lightly on the breath and to follow it. So again, we just begin to turn our awareness inward and just begin to watch our breath. Just breathing naturally, not trying to do anything with our breathing, just following it relaxedly. Any thoughts that arise, just welcome them, but recognize they're just radiance of mind. And for now, we don't need to follow them. We can just turn our attention back to our breath. Bring our awareness to the sensation at the rim of the nostrils where the air enters. So now just bring your awareness to the sensation of air as you're inhaling. It's cool or warm, just notice. And if you don't have a particular sense of sensation in that way, just let that go. And again, just notice inhalation. All we're doing now is noticing. We're not following after it. We're not in any way contemplating or attaching thoughts to it. We're just noticing. And now we can turn our awareness to our exhalation. And now if any sensations like temperature or just whether you're feeling the nostril or not, if it's just the feeling of the exhalation of the body movement, that's fine. It makes no difference. All you're doing now is turning your attention to exhalation. And now you might, if you do have a sensation of your heart beating, you can pay attention to that. And now it may just be a thought, but the fact that your heart beats means that moving through your body is the blood. Moving through your veins and arteries. But again, right now, the object is not to think, it's just to be aware. Now again, you can think as you're inhaling the experience of your belly or your whole or your chest. If you're deep breathing, feel the experience or the sensation of the body moving as you breathe in, expanding. And then feeling the body contracting as you're exhaling. Again, in any kind of muscle way, you're not muscling here, you're just relaxedly breathing in and out and noticing the movement in your body as you're breathing in, the expansion, and as you're exhaling, the contraction. And now we'll add some contemplative reflection, which is going to be the meditation on change. So again, we remain aware of the sensations of our body or within our body, but now we can begin to become aware of the dimension of change. So we can think to ourselves, my body is moving. Changing. This breath is coming in and going out, changing. I am breathing in new air, changing. I am breathing out old air, changing. I am breathing in new air, changing. I am breathing out old air, changing. I am part of this universe. The air is part of this universe. With each breath, with each inhalation, the universe changes. With each exhalation, the universe changes. This air that I am breathing, that I am taking in and then expelling, is part of this universe. So with each breath, the universe changes. This is interdependence. The air that is affected by, that affects me, when it is released or exhaled, is taken into the universe and affects the air in the universe outside of me. If there were no air outside of me, if conditions were to change, and I were suddenly to find myself in a vacuum, I could so no longer be alive. So let's just think of the effect we have on everything around us, and the effect everything around us has on ourselves, and that everything, ourselves and everything around us, is continually changing. Each inhale fills my lungs. Each inhale brings oxygen to my blood, changing, body changing. Each sensation is temporary. Each breath temporary. Each rising and falling temporary, all changing, transforming. With each exhale, the old me dies. With each inhale, a new me is born. Becoming, renewing, dying, rebirth, change. As my body is changing, so are those of everyone I know. The bodies of my family and friends are changing. The planet is changing. The seasons are changing. Political regimes are changing. And when he says my monasteries are changing, for those of you who are affiliated with KTC, we know clearly the changes taking place at the monastery with the death of our former abbot, Lama Norla Rinpoche, and us learning how to run the monastery ourselves and accustoming ourselves to the new lamas that have come in, who themselves have to accustom themselves to the idea of running a monastery. Everything is uncertain. Everything is new. Everything has changed and continues to change. The whole universe is changing. In, out, breathing in, out, expansion, contraction. And now look at whatever is arising in mind, when it arises, if anything arises. And notice that no matter how much you might try to hold on to whatever thought or idea or sensation, the notion of duration is completely a fiction. Mind itself is constantly changing. It's a dynamic phenomenon. Everything that's arising is arising within awareness. Everything passes with its own accord, just by its own nature, being impermanent. And now, let go of everything. Try to just let go of clinging. And rest in open awareness, in which you're aware of whatever arises in every aspect, through every sense, and with the mind itself, but without clinging to anything that arises. Simply try to rest in the present moment of awareness, in the present moment of experience. Try to remain in the presence, in the present. And you can remain resting while I just read this one paragraph that begins on page 42 and ends at the top of 43 when Mingyur Rinpoche says, "The confusion that arises when we cling to our beliefs and expectations obscures the innate clarity of our awakened minds. At the same time, this confused conceptual mind simply does not have the capacity to understand mind beyond concepts. We use language to describe awakening, awareness, emptiness, spacious luminosity, enlightenment, realization, and all sorts of other concepts that defy description. Words can point towards the way, and we can definitely experience our own inner wakefulness, but we cannot conceive of it. Every idea that we have about waking up remains far removed from experience." So now we'll just continue in the text. I'm on page 44, just referring to one line on page 44. At the very bottom, the last line in the last full paragraph where it reads, "Every movement of the mind and every emotional reaction is still just a small wave on the vast surface of the awakened mind." And now I'm skipping to page 45, where it's the fifth line down, and it says, when we connect to our own awareness, then we can accommodate whatever arises. The big waves of loved ones dying and relationships ending, and the ripples of crashed computers and delayed flights. No wave stays the same shape. All crests fall. Let it be. Let it pass. Become bigger than the thought, bigger than the emotion. Everything is always in flux. By letting it be, we simply allow for inherent movement. We can notice preference and desire, but chasing after them blocks the flow of change. And skip to the next paragraph. Let it be makes it possible to see that our true nature is free from problems, distress, and suffering, and that it always has been. When we stop trying to make the surface calm and accept that the very nature of ocean is change, we begin to experience this inner freedom. But this is not freedom from distress and anxiety. It is freedom that can be experienced with stress and anxiety. We are liberated from suffering by correctly perceiving reality. This means that we can have the insight and experience to know that our minds are so much vaster than we generally think they are. We are not the size and shape of our worries. To recognize reality as it is makes recognition and liberation simultaneous. On the train, as many times as my mind got carried off by strong winds, I used the continuity of change to bring myself back to unconditioned perceptions. Let it be. If I had not totally trusted through my own experiences and the teachings I had received that change is constant and that we are never separated from the spacious skylight mind, my courage to continue might have faltered. Now more than ever, with no friends, no shelter, no attendant, no student, no teacher role, my mind was my only protection. And I had to trust that death leads to rebirth, even when in the process of dying, this trust can elude us. So now I'd like us just to turn to page 48, which is the last part of this. And I just want to read a little bit from the Bardo, because it really helps. It helped me understand what was meant by the Bardo. And then he gives a tremendous metaphor that also helps to do this. And so this probably will not take more than, 10 minutes to read. So if anyone wanted to take a break and ask a question or bring a comment in, this would be a good time to have a break. And then we'll finish up with the last few pages of comments from the next chapter, which is called, What Will You Do in the Bardo? Okay, well, why don't we then continue? And then afterwards, if anyone has any comments they'd like to bring up. So I'm now continuing on page 48, where it says, what will you do in the Bardo, my father has asked. One of my older brothers had moved down to the densely populated city of Kathmandu, and after a few months he came to visit us at Nagi Gompa. My brother complained about the cars that honked and backfired and the dogs that barked all night. He winced, describing Hindi love songs blasting from transistor radios and fake gurus who sermonize through loudspeakers. And the brother speaking says, I cannot meditate. I cannot maintain my mental composure. My sleep is fitful. And I feel stressed all the time, he explained. With genuine concern, my father had gently asked, what will you do in the bardo. And so we skip to page 49 to the first full paragraph where it starts in colloquial usage. In colloquial usage, when my father asked, "What will you do in the bardo?" he was referring to the bardo of becoming, the stage between dying and rebirth, an intermediate period fraught with difficulties for those who have cultivated no mental equanimity in this lifetime. Yet as my brother's predicament suggested, intermediate also applies to a disturbed mind within this life. My brother was in between a quiet rural life and a noisy urban experiment. He was in between the old and familiar and the new and unknown, in between past and present. My father's question, addressed to each of us, is, what will you do in the midst of frightening sounds, or on a crowded, reeking train, or in a terrorist attack, or in a war, or in any one of life's countless unwanted events, a diagnosis of ill health, a flat tire, a perception of being slighted or disrespected or rejected? What will you do when you experience your life as being interrupted by undesired circumstances? Will you maintain a steady mind that can accommodate what you don't want and actually be of benefit to yourself and others? Or will you implode through fear, anger, or loss of control? How do we act when we do not get what we want, or when we do not want what we have? Continuing on the next page, I am in the bardo of becoming right now, between the death of the old me and the birth of whatever comes next. Becoming, becoming, always in the bardo of the unknown, the uncertain, the transient. For conventional Tibetans, the bardos categorize stages from physical birth to rebirth, but many teachers, including my father and Selje Rinpoche, transmitted bardo teachings as an inner journey of the mind, and this is now my own understanding. In the conventional version of the bardo of becoming, we enter a stage in between the physical death of this body and rebirth into a new form. The mind loses its lifelong mooring and continues beyond the death of the body. But with a broader application, we don't need to wait until we physically die in order to know the bardo of becoming. Most of us have had plenty of experience with feeling sane and stable, and then sometimes we fall apart. We cannot hold it together. The patchwork unravels, and the ground beneath us drops out. We find ourselves in between one state of mind and another. In extreme cases, we find ourselves in totally unfamiliar and frightening mental landscapes. These experiences of falling apart commonly occur with traumatic events that include shock and upheaval. Everyday occurrences of heartbreak and loss can be so wrenching and unexpected that they interrupt familiar ideas that we have about ourselves. This is the same kind of experience that might happen when we step into a hellish railroad station the very first time we are alone in the world. The rupture knocks us off our feet, and we feel like we are falling or drowning, going down. We desperately strive to get back on firm ground, to feel safe and supported, even when we identify safety as a small island of familiar mental territory that is habituated to misperception. And this is what really got me, is that what it takes to feel safe and supported is simply identifying with a small isle of familiar mental territory that itself is a misperception. That really got me. And then continuing, just because he gives a little definition of bardo, he says, bardo can be understood to mean this very moment, the nowness of this moment. is the continual suspension or pause in between our transitory experiences, both temporal and spatial, such as the tiny halt that exists between this breath and the next, or the arising and fading of this thought and the next. The interval can also be experienced as the in-between of two objects, the gap between two trees or two cars, the space that provides definition, or we can understand this interval as the emptiness that allows us to see form. Actually, everything is in between. However minuscule the interval might be, it always exists and it is always bracketed. Everything in the whole world system exists in between something else. From this perspective, the exclusive reference of intermediate to the state between death and rebirth emerges as the prototype for transitions that occur within this life cycle. The Bardo stages then illuminate how these iconic death to life transitions emerge in everyday experience. And now I skip to the next paragraph where it says, what if, I now asked myself, we could enter relationships more like we enter a train. We know that the train will move, then stop and move again through changing landscapes and weather systems. What if we enter relationships knowing that the thrill of new romance or the excitement of a new business partnership or the initial encounter with a spiritual mentor will not be the same in the future as it is in the beginning? What if we expected new positive circumstances to change rather than wished they would stay the same? The train makes many stops. We do not try to prolong them, and we do not expect the train to stay in one place. It passes through places just as we pass through the Bardos. The Bardos show us that everything is always in transition. And whether becoming applies to transitions between mental identifications with this lifetime or many other lifetimes, the challenge remains the same: to liberate ourselves by letting go of grasping onto our self-constructed narratives. And so I skip down to the second to last paragraph where it says, with the help of the breathing exercises, the speed of the grasping mind slowed, allowing me to connect with a subtle level of constant change. Every instance that brings attention to change helps us to stabilize the understanding of impermanence as the immutable condition of our lives. As a path toward liberation, intellectual acknowledgement of impermanence must become integrated with embodied experience. Then we can gain more support for giving up grasping at those things we cannot hold, whether that means our own bodies or those of people we love or our roles or our prestige. And that's where I end today. Marilyn, hold on, Marilyn. Oh, Marilyn, I think
she's unmuted.
Okay. Well, there's so many things to talk about. I do have to say that his discussion, based on his father's and Salgay Rinpoche's way of thinking about the Bardo teachings as an inner journey of the mind, is very much the way Lama Chodron has expressed to us Pema Chodron's talking about the 12, the cycle of the cyclic existence. And as a matter of fact, having read ahead slightly, I think he's going to get to that too. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I wanted to bring out is it's no wonder we have such difficulty with doing this, because you've just listened to the words constant change stabilize, impermanence, immutable. And you, I mean, these, it's no wonder in the beginning, when I first started, I was like, I can't, it seems like it's one thing and then the other, you know, it's just like, no wonder we have to stop thinking and start doing to get it, because the words themselves are like, what? What do you mean here? These are opposites. So yeah. There's a whole lot more in here, but the last bits just grabbed me.
Yeah, I guess it's, am I unmuted? Okay. That, you know, it's a paradox that, again, you know, and it's very paradoxical. And yet the whole idea of constancy is, what is constant is that everything is not constant. Yeah, it's very interesting. And, you know, I had this is a side, but what helped me for a while is when it talked about like every moment of awareness is the same. And I realized, no, it's not an enduring sameness and continuity in time. It's that in each moment, the characteristics are the same. So this whole notion of constancy or continuity is problematic. Although interestingly for me, taking film, like when I was a film assistant film editor in the old days, actually working with film, where you had the literal, you know, separated cells of film, that this idea of continuity, first I learned continuity because I was a script supervisor as well, and you had to get continuity because if you filmed one scene, you had to make sure that when you picked up either a close-up or a reverse to get a reaction, that if someone's hand was like this, their hand was still like this in the main thing. You know, it had to have, again, this delusion, you know, or illusion that it was continuous, their actions, that the scene wasn't being filmed from all different directions and over many different takes, but also that continuity, that this idea that separate cells of film are, which are running through space, that there's the illusion that there's a constancy, and the differentiation between continuity and constancy, because they don't remain, they're not the same thing either. So you're absolutely right. It's such a paradox of thinking that what is constant in our lives is the fact that nothing remains the same. Nothing is constant.
Well, I think that what there's one other thing that can be constant, which is awareness, which is what we're trying to do. Like what every one of those individual moments and experiences has in common is that we can be aware of them. Mm-hmm. And often we're not. So that's what we're cultivating. So our practice is the ability to be up when it's up and down when it's down, and know what's happening, to actually know what's happening in all of these moments.
Yeah.
I was wondering if anybody had anything to report. Oh, sorry. Were you going to say something, Lama Jinzong?
No, that's okay. Go on.
Yeah. Okay. Any about the practices, like most of us are doing the Dying Every Day course, and I sent out last week right after class the practice instructions that go along with the course to be aware of your breath going in and out, and notice how your experience of the breath is changing moment by moment, and then notice all the changes in the body, which Lama Jinzong took us through that meditation on that. And then also in daily life to become aware of the ups and downs of our emotional states. Anybody able to apply those things? Anybody have any particular experience with those? Angela, I'm going to unmute you. You're unmuted.
I have a lot of huge changes in my life because my mother passed and I got to have that.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, and then my grandmother passed. And this is all within 6 weeks. I broke my foot.
Oh, garlic.
My location. I have to find a new job. And then my son just got in an auto accident yesterday. So it's really like, and me and my son were laughing about it after I got him out of the hospital yesterday about how continuity was, you know, how it's just really, he called it a fever dream because, you know, he had a weird morning and he got into an accident, and then we went to the hospital and talked to all the doctors, and then we're laughing at a Mexican restaurant. So thankfully he's fine, but it just really kind of brings all of this to life more because my life is not, I have no ground. It's just, every day is change, and I wake up and go, what can I do today to make this be a little bit more stable for my kids? And, you know, so it's good. As Nigar Rinpoche would say, it's a lot of practice. I'm heavy with the jewels of practice, so I'm rich in, yeah. And it really gives me an opportunity to live it and not be a stressed out basket case like I would be normally. I mean, I have been emotionally upset and flowing through that and just knowing it's going to flow out and it'll be fine and I'll come back, it's fine, you know. It's given me so much. I can even remember the crazy times, you know, that I've spent in the past and knowing that I'm not acting that crazy and how much benefit practice is and to let go and to let go in every moment just absolutely gives you that peace and freedom to be there for the people you want to be there for, because I need to be there for my kids and other people right now, not just myself, and going through all that. So, yeah.
I also,
so it sounds like you're finding that the practice helpful.
Amazing. Yeah.
Sorry, Lam Jinzang, you were saying?
I can't remember. It's gone. There you go. Impermanence.
Hey. Okay, well, thanks for letting us know, Angela. I'm sorry for your very significant losses and all the turmoil, but it's wonderful that you're able to practice with it. Anybody else?
I have something quick. This is Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. One thing.
Yeah, Mark, go ahead, and then Marilyn has her hand up too.
I'm sorry. Yeah, one Mark. Helps a lot is, to me anyway, is the focus being on the mind, particularly, you know, the impermanence in the mind rather than the impermanence of external phenomena or objects. And that really greases the wheels as far as I'm concerned. So you realize that because the meditations that you gave us are all kind of internal, watching changes in the emotions and things like that. So to me, I think he asked in the book somewhere, where people usually ask, where's my watch and where are my shoes and stuff, and said, not very many people ask, where's my mind, you know? Anyway,
well, I think that, you know, that's where we come into this idea that it's really turning your mind inward and looking our own personal experience to find the truth of the Dharma, because you know, you can look outside all you want, but, you know, you don't know the truth of something unless you yourself have experienced it. And once you've experienced it in a certain way, you can say whether that's true for you or not. And I think that, you know, that's what it's really about, you know, because it's like, can you talk the talk or can you walk the walk? You know, it's how to internalize. You know, and that's also a thing that it says here with when it talks about the line that the fact is that words themselves can only point to experience, but they cannot in any way truly describe the experience. Experience has to be, it has to be felt. It has to be, you know, cannot be known conceptually. So it says here, 43. You know, words can point towards the way and we can definitely experience our own wakefulness, but we cannot conceive of it. And every idea that we have about waking up remains far removed from experience. So everything is about our personal experience. And I found this also to be a very interesting fact that it took breathing exercises, which I've always known to be a form of calm abiding to help us, you know, focus our mind or gain some stability of concentration, to now use our own breath to really, finally, really work at, yes, I myself am changing constantly, that there's no such thing as permanence or constancy anywhere. And then also this interdependence, this idea that the breath that I'm taking in affects the air around me, and the air that I'm exhaling is affecting the air around me, that it also brings home the interdependence of everything. So we're using our own experience now to really say, yeah, stuff is impermanent thing, or not just impermanence, it's that things are changing. Because for me, impermanence, like I said earlier, sort of can sometimes just be like, impermanence is dying, and it doesn't, for me anyway, changing. Transformation brings this idea that for me more fully that there is a continuation. It's a transformation that takes place. And so having us focus on our own physical bodies and then also connecting even just with the air around us, like he says, the universe, to, you know, again, bring home interdependence, which is also about impermanence, that nothing exists on its own. Everything needs those conditions to come together in order for something to occur. And then when those conditions are no longer there, it's gone. So I found this to be really just profound.
Okay, Marilyn, I think you're unmuted.
Oh, okay. Two things. The experience of that Mindy Rinpoche talks about, that we are, well, I won't pray, but I am not my anger. To breathe at the time of angry reaction means that I create space around the anger. And so it's a clear distinction between my being consumed by anger or hurt or whatever it is, and it being something that I'm witnessing. It doesn't happen all the time, but it's happening some. And then the other thing I wanted to say is that I was in the doctor's waiting office today, and I ran into somebody that I sort of know peripherally, and he wanted to know what I was reading. And I was reading In Love with the World. And he said, what? And I said, well, you know, I've been a Buddhist. You know, we've had a sense. Why? And I said, because it makes sense. And that's why it makes sense. You know, even the things that I didn't understand in the beginning, I just never mind, you know, like never mind. But it just makes sense. That's what's so amazing. That's it.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Anyone else have something?
Yeah, this whole
sorry. Sorry, Lama Chodron, because then Dave has something.
But no, that's okay. We're gonna let Dave go. Oh, sorry. Right. Go ahead, Dave.
Am I on? Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah.
A lot of this stuff gets to the wisdom course that Mingyur Rinpoche was teaching, because he kind of keys into it at various points. And so like the impermanence, like you're saying, ties in with interdependence and also multiple rather than single. So he kind of broke down grasping and like the real experience, trying to get the experience of emptiness is there's three elements. There's mistaking, you know, things as permanent, as singular, and as independent rather than interdependent. So there's like those three dimensions that you kind of go into. And so like the impermanence, there's like that, like the meditation and the points you mentioned in the email are so helpful, because starting just with impermanence and doing it physically, but then applying all these things to the kleshas to see how they're, you know, empty, impermanent, you know, interdependent. And so like just doing that with your troubling emotion as it occurs, or for me, usually I can't get it as it occurs, but right after, is just very, very helpful.
Mm. Yeah. Lama Chodron, did you have something you wanted to add?
Anybody else have anything? We just have a couple of minutes left. Anybody else have anything they wanted to say? Because I need a minute at the end to talk about next week, but we still have another minute or so. Nobody has anything?
I personally find this to be, what a profound book. I mean, and I'm sure he was... I mean, it's just unbelievable. And this is why Lama Chodron was saying that really the instructions here are really like for, you know, where we are in the OPL, in the other course of the Kamhopa course, it's really, this is the sixth paramita of working with wisdom chapter. And this is all instructions for how to work with mind. And the fact that he's providing active meditations for us to participate in, I mean, what could be better? This so. It's really interesting. It's really amazing, this book. That's all.
Great. So what I was just going to say was that this discussion is making me hark back to the three kinds of faith from, it's somewhere in Gampopa, Precious Human Existence. I think he teaches the three kinds of faith. But what I'm hearing a lot from people is like this sort of confidence in our experience now. Like Marilyn says, it makes sense, or Angela was able to use this, you know, just the understanding of impermanence even to navigate really rough territory, like really intensely rough territory. And so the three kinds of faith, just to quickly review, those are, first, it's inspired faith by seeing the Buddha or, you know, meeting a teacher or whatever. And so something sort of wakes up a little bit, like this is very meaningful. And so you go, you know, you get by on that inspiration for a while, and then you start to realize that you could do it yourself. And that's the faith of aspiration, that you could actually travel this path and you actually could wake up. And so I think we're seeing, I mean, we've all been on the path for quite a while now, and I think we're seeing a little bit of the fruit of that in terms of seeing our experience unfold and having confidence in the teachings through our own experience. And that's the third kind of faith, is the faith of trust or the faith of confidence. Seeing it like, yeah, karma is really true, impermanence is really true, and so forth. So I just thought that was a good time to to insert the three kinds of faith. Which can be kind of an abstract thing when you first come across it, but it's actually the living path. The three kinds of faith is just another way of expressing how the path unfolds.
I've always had a
hard time.
Just because they describe the faiths with, and they're translated differently. So even now you use the term second aspiration. So just quickly, what would you, because it was very nice the way you said it, what words do you give to the three kinds of faith?
Well, I got these, I can't remember where I got these now.
That was like inspiration and then aspiration and trust. That's really nice.
Yeah, inspiration is what I think in the, like somewhere where we first heard it was clarity or something like that, the faith of clarity or lucidity. So first one's inspiration, second one's aspiration, and third one is confidence. And I got those from somewhere. I didn't make them up. It's one of the presentations uses those words, and I really like them. Might have been Trala Grimpache, but I don't remember. Anyway, since we're now slightly past 3:30, just quickly to talk about next week. So Lama Jinsung has wrapped up for us, I would say, the first bardo, the bardo of this life. And so next week we're going to talk about the bardo of dream. The reading for, I'll send this out in an email, but the reading for In Love with the World is just the next, it picks up at page 53 where Lama Jinsung left off. 53 through 116, it's chapters 7 through 13 is the reading. I don't know how closely it's going to correspond. I don't think there's an exact correspondence between the chapters and the bardos, because as I've been rereading it, I see that he's still talking a lot about impermanence and the, you know, like the material for the bardo of this life. But I noticed for everybody who's taking the course, the webinar with Miyosh and Kelly is quite good. Mm-hmm. It was from last Saturday, I think. And so if you have a chance to listen to that, I highly recommend it. She went over, it was really sort of going back over a lot of the material in the section of the course, but it was through people's questions. Like people, it was almost everybody, I think every question, every single question was about the bardo of dream and how to work with lucid dreaming. Because in the bardo of dream, he gives us like actual practice to do at night with our dreams and how to do it. It's really quite a practical and interesting section. So I look forward to talking about that next week. Anybody have anything before Lama Jinsung leads us in the prayers? Kathy, I'm unmuting you.
Thank you. Steve had recommended the Netflix little series on mindfulness, and the second one is on dreaming. And I watched that last night, and it is really interesting. And I think that it's worth adding to the, you know, to this section
To the watch list.
Okay.
To the watch list, yeah.
Yeah. The watch list. Is that the series that has Mingyur Rinpoche in it?
Yes.
Or is
yes.
that like a different thing?
No, yeah, it's the same series. And okay. Yeah, it's really interesting. So
okay. Yeah, it's called
I'll track down.
They're only like 20 minutes, so it's really great.
Okay. So who was saying where it is? Who was?
It's on
Mind Meta? Explained.
Yeah,
it's called there Mind it is. Explained.
Thank you, Fanny. I'll send that out in an email too.
And it's 10 minutes.
Great.
Episodes.
I've been wanting to look at that. Okay. Wonderful. Great. And they're short?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great. Well, I'm going to turn it over back to the lawman. Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you, Fanny. I'm going to turn, or whoever that was. I'm going to turn it back over to Lama Jinzong to lead us in the prayer.
Okay. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu Zampo and Mandrushri, to train myself in their example. I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication, please fulfill.
That's a little over time.
Thanks, guys.
Looking
thanks,
forward everybody. To seeing everybody again.
That was excellent.
Soon.
Thank you.